Hey everyone, Keshav here and John, my partner. We're here at Climate Capital, and today with us we have Ray Mazzi from Southern Waters Capital. Ray is involved in various industries across real estate, but today we're going to talk about what him and I both love, the build-to-rent sector, and specifically how build-to-rent is being affected in this current market volatility. So Ray, if you could just give us a little background about your experience and what you do, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, no, first off, thanks, John and Keshav, for having me. So a little bit about myself and my firm. So I'm a recovering attorney, as most attorneys say when they no longer practice. Happily stopped practicing like 4 or 5 years ago. I actually just walked out of an alumni event for my law school. So it's kind of interesting to see everybody from back in the day who's still down in the legal world. But so I started my firm about 3 years ago. My background, as I mentioned, I was an attorney originally, worked in the startup world for about a year and a half, and then was lucky enough to leverage my skills of being an attorney and working at that startup firm into starting my own firm, where at Southern Waters Capital, we focus on real estate development, ground up, mostly. We're dabbling in the value add space as markets shift, but truly we're ground up developers of rental housing with the focus on build to rent, and some multifamily as well. But as we all know, build to rent is really the hot topic these days and what's garnering the most attention, and is certainly being performing the has the most durability through the market so far. So my firm, we have just over 1,700 units in development in one stage or the other. We're still focused primarily on Florida. We have a couple of projects we're looking at outside of Florida, but really, as everybody knows, you know, the net migration and market fundamentals in the state of Florida are pretty strong, especially since the pandemic kind of threw gasoline on the fire, if you will. So, in addition to myself, I have a team of about five people, but the partners at the firm are myself, Dean Myro. He's 25 years my senior, spent 30 years on Wall Street. He also is a recovering attorney, but he never really practiced. He went right into the distressed debt space on the bond side, sold his firm, or started his firm in 97, sold it in 2005 to BB&T. He stayed on at BB&T for a decade to run their capital markets project finance division nationally from 2005 to 2015. So navigated the great financial crisis. So, you know, this cycle is definitely not the same as 08 or 07, but it certainly rhymes with it. And there's some underlying themes that we've been able to identify and lean on thanks to his experience. In addition to Dean Myro, we have Andrew Sinclair. Andrew is a longtime friend of mine. Over a decade now, we've known each other. But more importantly, he has his master's in finance, worked as a consultant for lending institutions while he was at RSM for a few years outside of right out of college, and then spent about 6 years at Turner Construction running cost analysis and project management from the corporate office, not boots on the ground, but has handled budgets from, you know, $5 million to a little bit over $900 million working on Blue Origin's launch complex in the Space Coast. So between the three of us, really Andrew and Dean have the most technical skills. Andrew makes sure that everything pencils. Dean makes sure that the credit markets will accept the project as we design it. And I'm the lucky guy who gets to go chase dirt and look for equity in addition to the equity that we bring to the table. So that's kind of us in a nutshell, who the players are on our team. And as I mentioned, most of our assets currently are in the state of Florida, but we're happy to perform throughout the Sun Belt. So thanks for having me.
Thanks for the intro, Ray. One of the things that you mentioned was that build-to-rent's doing fairly well, right? Or like holding up fairly well in this market cycle right now, right? Given the current conditions, why would you say it is?
Well, the skeptical side of me just says because it's the hot thing. I mean, I don't like to BS people, and I think it's important to always shoot it straight. Truly, Wall Street does a good job of labeling things and giving things new titles and packaging to make it more popular. So I'll get off this soapbox in a moment, but truly Build to Rent's been around for a long time. It's been around for over a decade. When you look at companies like Next Metro and other companies like them, and it's been around much longer than a decade if you just look at individual investors who have assembled portfolios. But Wall Street has done a good job of packaging up, giving it a nice name, and knocking 50 basis points off the exit price. So that's my skeptical point of view. The true economic point of view, I would say, is that it really is where the demand is. I mean, it's as simple as that. People have this, since the pandemic happened, it's this flight to freedom and free space, if you will. And people have found that in Build to Rent communities. And, you know, not everybody wants to live in a high rise. And when you can find more space at an economic price, which is Build to Rent, it's an attractive place to live for families who can't afford to buy and or families who just prefer to rent. I'm a renter myself. I can certainly buy a home. I own homes, but I prefer to rent as well. So it resonates with me. So the short answer is it's the thing Wall Street's pushing. And second to that, they're probably pushing it because that's where the demand is really strong. Now that's me speaking to the Southeast. I don't know about the rest of the United States, but that's why Build to Rent, in my opinion, is performing so well throughout this market turmoil, if you will.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. But as far as not letting us get ahead of ourselves, how would you mitigate risk when you're going into a Build to Rent project? Just to make sure that, you know, you're not just, like you said, riding the wave that Wall Street's trying to push and that you're actually able to for your investors.
Yeah, super important question, right? For me, I'm a little bit different. So I have a legal background. I really do start far before many other developers do. I come in pre-entitlement. I'm the one who handles all the entitlements. So what I really look for at the base level is, do I want to own this as a land play? Would I be happy to hold this asset for 5 to 10 years just as a piece of dirt if I re-entitled it and, you know, just had to pay taxes on it going forward? So it's truly not complicated. Real estate's very simple. It's just really, really difficult. And your money's made on the buy, and it's all about your location. So it's location and basis. And then the third thing would be, do you have a strong balance sheet to hold the asset long term and not have to leverage it? So what do? I look at something and I say, hey, look, if the market's buying it at 20K a door entitled, I want to be in it at 10K a door unentitled, and I'll handle the entitlements myself. And maybe it creeps up to 12 or 13K a door throughout the entitlement process because of the capital I put in. But it's easy to show the next buyer or the next investor, hey, this is the money I spent. This is the competitive price I was able to buy the asset at, and here's where the market's buying at. And that delta between my price and the market price is really my cushion. And I don't want to get into anything without having, you know, 8 to 10 grand of cushion per door at the very least. And, you know, I'm sure tons of people who are more experienced probably listen. They're like, yeah, well, you're never going to find that. I would say that they're impatient. They're not looking hard enough. So for me, it's really making sure that the dirt is worth the dollars I'm spending, and I'm not ending up having to flip out of the dirt because I overpaid a year or so ago when I first started my entitlement journey.
When you're going in on the land, are you going all in cash, or are you taking out leverage? Like Correct. You said, to make sure that you can weather the storm.
I think it's a general rule of thumb for anybody that, or this should be a general rule of thumb for anybody. If it doesn't cash flow, you shouldn't leverage it.
So, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Let's see. And as far as like underwriting, we all know the typical, you know, like exit cap rates, conservative rent growth, things like that. Are you doing anything else out of the ordinary, again, to mitigate risk?
No, I think what people need to know is that you need 125 to 150 basis points of spread between your exit cap and your yield on cost. And you need to be conservative in both your analyses of that yield on cost and your exit cap. And if you can't secure that spread, do not spend the money on that dirt. And it's really funny how people will say, I have 150 bips of spread. And then next thing you know, you look and it's just based off these ridiculously trended rents or some type of financial engineering. And honestly, I think my biggest skill is my lack of financial engineering and my inability to get super creative and all this kind of stuff. It's truly the KISS model. We keep it simple, stupid. And that's exactly how we operate our business. And don't get me wrong, I'll juice a deal with financial engineering if I can, but at a base level, if it doesn't underwrite with a simple underwriting process and a decent amount of spread, then you shouldn't be getting into it. And I'm lucky. My business partner, Dean, like I said, he's 25 years my senior. He spent 30 years on Wall Street and has lived through some cycles, and he knows your money's made on the buy. And it's this simple. You can't change your location and you can't change your basis. You never can. These are the two things that just never change in real estate. People can argue, oh, well, I changed my basis on a per unit, from a per unit perspective because I pushed entitlements, yada, yada. Doesn't matter. You still spent X amount of dollars, and that asset, because it's real estate, is not going to move. This isn't the metaverse. You can't move your ones and zeros to a new website. This is real estate, and it's not going to move from where you bought it. So you need to know that you bought it at the right price and in the right location. And then, like I said, you know, balance sheet is really the only other thing that helps you weather the storm. So we're just looking for spread like anybody else. We play it really simple. It's just tough.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. When you say location, what do you look for in location? If you want to throw out numbers, whether it's like population growth, job diversity, things like that. Specifically, maybe it's, you know, built around specific too.
Yeah. So how I'll answer the question in a different way, but how I sell a deal is really simple. First, it's the market. Do you like the market, Mr. or Mrs. Investor? Second, do you like my location within that market? Third, do you like my basis? Fourth, do you like my product? Fifth, do you like my team? That's it. It's that simple. So when I'm looking at a market, it's supply and demand in the most fundamental sense. If you have a lack of supply, whether it's old supply, whether it's mismatched supply based off the product to the tenant demographic that's moving to the area or whatever it is your supply inadequate compared to the demand that's coming in? And is your demand durable? In addition to that, is your economic growth diverse and durable? Do you have more than one industry? Hopefully you have 3 to 4 industries that are really strong. Like in Ocala, we talk about there's manufacturing, there's logistics, there's back office, there's healthcare, and there's equine. It's really 5 strong industries, and even 2 of those weren't that great. There's certainly 3 strong industries. It's been less than 1,000 units or so built in the past decade for rent purposes only. So there's obviously not that much supply. In addition to that, you have 190 people moving there a week, and you have the highest in-out ratio measured by U-Haul out of the entire nation. For every one person that leaves, 5 people move in. So it's like really, really simple stuff like that, where you just find this economic mismatch between the growth in the economy, the local economy, the mismatch in the supply and demand, and then whether or not you're able to deliver assets or product that matches that tenant demographic and that tenant demand in locations at a good basis. You know what I mean? That you can execute on in the time that's in the same window where the demand is coming in. So, you know, it's like when I read the books like Principles by Ray Dalio, he makes these really complex things sound super simple. And it's because they are super simple, they're just really tough. And if you make them complex, it's really like an excuse, in my opinion. Making things complex is really like an excuse to get something wrong. Really, things are super simple. They're just really, really difficult. And if you want to, you can create some convoluted analysis about this many people are moving in versus this many jobs that are there versus the median income that's rising at this rate or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's how many homes are available to renters, how many people are moving there that are actually going to rent, and what is the income that those people are likely to achieve when they move to your area, and does your product match that tenant demographic? And that's what we're looking for. So for me, to make it super simple for your listeners, it's can you achieve $2 a square foot as a rental rate? And do you have a true imbalance in supply and demand? And if you have those two things with a strong, with a decent economic growth, you could probably make a deal work so long as you find a good location.
You do make it sound so simple.
I had a quick question about location. So I know you're primarily located in Florida. Is that primarily because you have vertical integration in Florida? You have your team based there, property management, and you know the area. And what would make you look outside of the Florida area?
Yeah. So again, super simple. I follow my relationships. That's it. It's the only thing that won't commoditize in this world. People are freaking out about AI and everything, but at the end of the day, AI will never take you out to lunch and talk to you and make you feel really good. It may if you log in, but we're actually the least vertically integrated company you'll ever talk to. We're just developers. We're just sponsors. I'm really excited to start different divisions of my company, which we will do in the next year or two with property management and a GC arm and all this kind of stuff. But as we sit now, if a deal pencils for Southern Waters Capital, it most likely pencils for anybody because we're conservative underwriters. We're very, very fundamental analysis focused group, and we're value oriented. So why I'm in Florida and why I'm looking in places like Tennessee is because I have really strong contacts there. I used to work for the governor here in the state of Florida, worked for a few state agencies, and was lucky enough to be employee number one at a startup where I basically went around the state talking to people and advocating and raising capital. So, you know, I can reach out to people in many different, at any of the 67 counties here in the state of Florida and get a hold of whomever I think I need to. But yeah, really what it is, it's finding those, people say off market all the time. The amount of times I've heard off market is just ridiculous, but truly finding deals where I'm calling somebody who may have just had a brother who passed away or something terrible like that. I used to be an estate planning and tax attorney. So, you know, I'm pretty good at navigating those situations, but at the end of the day, I'm finding unique opportunities in places where I have relationships that I believe have the fundamental characteristics of a strong market. And just the net migration in Florida is ridiculous. I mean, if you look at it compared to other states, it's great. And you'll read an article here and there that's like, Florida's unaffordable. It's, yeah, sure. Anywhere's unaffordable if you go to the rich areas. But if you don't live on the coast or don't live on, you know, Maine and Maine or whatever you want to call it, which is the most popular area in whatever town you live in, then you can find a very affordable place to live in Florida. I have under contract right now like 50 plus homes at just over $100,000 a unit. And don't get me wrong, they're not the most gorgeous places in the world, but they certainly satisfy demand that's highly active. They're not the sexiest product, but the yield definitely is. So I'm in Florida and other places because of my relationships and because I think that they have the fundamental characteristics of a market that's not only durable, but it has a lot of meat left on the bone for me and my investors.
Thanks for the in-depth response. When you're analyzing these opportunities, you mentioned, right, conservative underwriting, how do you analyze and come to a conclusion on what a reasonable exit cap rate is for build to rent, since there's not a lot trading out there? You know, you can kind of look to like class A multifamily, but
mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I just look at prevailing cap rates in the multifamily market in the area I'm in. So usually I used to get beat up for being too conservative on my cap rate exits. And then it's funny, we never changed our underwriting. We never have. Not from day one to today. I've never changed the amount I want to pay per unit. I've never changed my exit cap rate. I've never changed my yield on cost target. Have yield on cost targets been harder to achieve? Definitely. Our exit cap rates question more? Sure, but I was always conservative. So, you know, I've never penciled anything at an exit cap rate lower than a 5 cap. And most of my stuff sits at a 5.5 cap in my pro formas today, but that's because I'm exiting the deal in 3 to 5 years. and I underwrite everything for a 10-year hold. So if I get stuck with the baby, I'm happy to hold it and rock it to bed for 10 years. It's not a big deal. So, you know, the lesson to people out there who are aspiring developers or want to do something is be conservative, because the last thing you want to do is get knee deep in a deal and realize you're actually, you know, you're in over your head. You don't want to be there. You'd much rather get the comment like, you know, you could be a lot more aggressive on your rents, or, you know, you could be a little bit more aggressive on your exit cap. I just say, sure. Then you underwrite it to that. But I get to stand firm on everything I put on paper. I don't have to waver, because I know I'm conservative, and I know that I truly have done the research, and this is where things are trading. And if you don't think they're going to trade there, then quite honestly, we're not going to be good partners.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, so I guess, like, what do you use as a reference though to determine that?
So I'll look at the multifamily cap rate exits
mm-hmm.
in the area, and I'll add 25 to 50 basis points. That's it.
Okay. That makes
right?
sense.
And you know, if you're talking about exiting in 3 or 4 years, it's not crazy to say we'll be in the fives again. I don't think so.
Right.
And if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong. We just hold a little bit longer and your IRR goes down, but hopefully your equity multiple goes up. So it's just a conversation you have. And that's why I deal with sophisticated investors, and I don't really deal with retail investors, because retail investors are like, oh, I'm getting an IRR of this or that. And, you know, it's just what's sold to them on paper.
Yeah. Anyone can fudge numbers.
Dude, I've gotten an MSF on my team who, like, we talk about it all the time. Andrew, I love the guy. He's my best friend and my good business partner. And it's funny, like, I'm like, if I needed a higher IRR, I can have him, you know, move a few numbers and I have a higher IRR. And if I need him to give me a better equity multiple, he can move a few numbers and do that. And he can increase my yield on cost without affecting my IRR by moving certain other numbers. And it's just, it becomes a stupid game. And really when I talk to investors, they say, do you disagree with any of my inputs? And if they do, we have the discussion. And then if they don't, I say, okay, well, underwrite it and let me know what you get. But I had an investor the other day underwrite my deal to a higher yield on cost than I had in my deck. And he's like, why is yours lower? I'm like, because you underwrite more aggressively than me. That's it. I mean, it's all about the inputs, right? Your outputs are only as good as your inputs. Garbage in, garbage out. So that's how we deal with it. And if you can't stand by your input assumptions, then you shouldn't be in the business.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And it's just not that complicated, right? Like, I'm just telling you super simple stuff. It's like, yeah, look at the rent comps in the area. Look at the sales comps in the area on a cap rate basis. Don't be a jerk and lower it by 50 basis points because you're not that special. Nobody's that special when they're building something new. Like, what are you going to do? What are you really going to do that's so different from the next guy or gal? Like, you're going to put in extra amenities? Like, that's okay. But do you really think that's going to fetch 25 extra bips? I don't think so. I think your NOI is what's going to drive your value. It's not going to be cap rate compression. And trust me, man, I talk to people who underwrite at 75 bips lower than my exit cap, but then the yield on cost comes in 100 bips lower on their yield on cost because they're way more conservative. It's just the way certain groups underwrite. So yeah. You just kind of have to play that game.
Yeah. You never know, some developers out there could be putting water parks or something. That could really stand out.
It's funny you say that. I've had people try and put in like a crystal lagoon in my deals before and everything. We joke about it. We joke about it at my firm because we were talking to some group about it, and like, it makes a lot of sense if you're doing some type of short-term rental, or if you want to charge locals to use your amenity or whatever. But I'm young in my career. I don't need to be doing anything fancy or special, or I'm not a visionary at this point. It's always funny. The more wealthy you get, the more visionary you become, it seems like. So I'm not that visionary yet, but it seems like I've met a few people on the trail to where I've gotten today that have, you know, have these grand visions, and they are able to sell those deals at different cap rates than I am. But I just know what I'm good at, and I try and stay in my lane.
Yeah, but Six Flags one day, amenities.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I'm not even a big roller coaster fan, so we'll go to the Crystal Lagoon deal. I'll do a water park.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And do you ever account for, having to exit earlier than even getting to the vertical, like selling right off after entitlements or after the horizontal?
Yeah, so my rule of thumb is if I can make 80% of what I'd make staying in the deal through stabilization and sale, then I'll sell the dirt. That was probably only a reality the past couple of years. It's most likely not what happens. But if I'm going to make $10 million by selling it at stabilization, but I can make $8 million today, then I'm out. I owe that to my investors. I should never take on inordinate amount of risk in order to achieve a smaller amount of margin. It just doesn't make sense. So for me, as much as I do love every piece of dirt I step on and put under contract, it's yield and risk and unit economics that drive my decision making, and I have to stay disciplined so I can go back to my investors and do another deal.
That's the name of the game.
Yeah, I learned the most. As a side note, just so everybody knows here, I mean, farmers are some of the smartest people on this planet, if not the smartest people on this planet. And I used to have a joke. I used to call them dirt bankers, because truly they taught me everything about unit economics. A farmer, some people might think, a Wall Street guy or gal might say, hey, how much do you make per acre? Or how much do you make per this or per that? And, they're really smart. They taught me how to break it down. It's like, Ray, I don't sell acres. I don't sell whatever. He's like, I grow plants. So I look at everything on a per plant basis. And that's when, it's super simple for me to come over to real estate and say, oh, everything's on a per unit basis. How much yield do I get per unit based off these inputs? And really, that's what drives your economics of a deal. So people may talk about the whole deals and where the money's going and how much they're making, but I always break it down. I'm like, listen, I don't care about your purchase price. I don't care about this. Like, what's your yield per unit? What's your cost per unit? Where's your risk at? What's the entitlement status? And, then we walk into the market fundamentals and things of that nature. So anyway, I just wanted to point that out. It's all about unit economics and the risks surrounding them. And from there, you can analyze anything. You can go into tech space. You can go into any space as long as you can identify the true unit that you're selling or trading in, whether it's a service or a product. You have to understand the unit economics. If you're looking at the wrong unit, you can blow yourself up. You're just not going to see, you're not going to see something that an experienced person is going to see in that industry.
Cool. Speaking of risks, what do you see, going ahead? We'll leave like legislatory, whatever the word is.
Legislative.
There we go. Legislative risks out of this. Like, that's a separate question we'll get to later. But yeah. Other market, financial, anything like that for build to rent.
Yeah. Well, real quick to the legislative thing here in Florida, we don't have to worry about that kind of stuff. But yeah, on the risk side, what am I most worried about? I mean, truly, I'm worried about them ratcheting interest rates up to over 6%. If you do something like that, I think this whole party stops. I think there's going to be a lot of halting. There's already a bunch of delays in projects. There's already a bunch of increased costs. But you could support increased construction financing. It's much harder to support increased permanent financing. So really the risk comes in the duration of how long we stay high on rates. I'm the type of guy who's like, I'm okay with high rates. I think it's healthy for our economy. It stinks that, when I started my firm and everything, it was all hot to trot. And now we're in a bit of a trough, if you will. But I will say this. I think we'd be fine if rates came down 100 basis points. I think we'd be fine. I think we could do deals now if you buy them the right price. And I think that would keep a healthy amount of deals on the in the pipeline coming to areas instead of this oversupply that is seemingly coming to most markets. People tell me all the time that like the biggest risks about your deals are the oversupply coming to your market. I always argue I was there first, so whatever, I'll beat them to market, yada yada. But at the end of the day, most of these deals actually aren't going to go through because of the way the market is right now. So the biggest risk is bumping up another 100 basis points and then staying there for a long time. We bump up 100 basis points and we stay there for a year or so, that sucks, but we'll be okay. If you stay there for a long time, it's a different game. And who knows how many more banks get whacked if we go up another 100 basis points. I always say it's funny. You know, I know hedge fund managers who all they do is trade in financial stocks and regional banks, to be specific. And their biggest thing is, you know, all this worry and concern goes away if the Fed says that they'll back every deposit that's out there. But when you do, and I have people who firmly believe in that. And then, you know, I'm more of a free market guy. And I think to myself, well, how do you purge the bad managers out of the banking system if you don't let them fail? JP Morgan can't buy every bank. The Fed can't buy every bank. Then I also asked myself, if I were a really wealthy guy, where would I put my money? And where would I, you know, would I, if I heard my bank was going under, what would I do? And it's really runs on the banks that ruin banks. And of course, bad banking, but it's the run on the bank that exposes them, right?
Yeah.
So the biggest risk is the human factor and the fear that can ripple through a market based off of certain people's attitudes. But what are you going to do, right? I mean, that's part of a free market. So to say it short, it's the risk lies in the fear that could spread through a market quickly. And second, it lies in if we bump up, you know, 75, 100 basis points more, we're in a different world. And a lot of banks are in trouble and a lot of people will get scared. And this economy's unemployment, I think, will surge over 5%, go right to 10%. And trust me, I haven't run the math, so don't quote me on it. But I think if we go up that much, I personally know people with technical degrees and strong backgrounds that are having a lot of trouble finding jobs. A lot of trouble. And I'm not trying to scare everybody, but people think that jobs are abundant. They're not right now. They're not abundant. And most people, in fact, I shouldn't say most people, but a good amount of people actually, the ones with jobs have multiple jobs. And the ones without jobs obviously have nothing. So it's a really weird world we live in. And of course, this goes out to all my millennial friends. They think they're worth way more than they are. They think they deserve so much money in pay. And like, I remember coming out of school with my JD MBA. I just left the governor's office and I made 55 grand a year. And most people would laugh and be like, I'd never take that. But that was the job that got me to where I am today. So it's just funny how people, the entitlement in my generation is honestly disgusting. But I'll get off that preach or that sermon, but that's my biggest fear is interest rates rising another 75 to 100 basis points. Fear getting to the point where there's runs on banks that don't deserve them. There's runs on banks that do that are deserving, but runs on banks that don't deserve them. And then lastly, our workforce not realizing that people need to take haircuts in times of trouble and distress. I see people saying like, I'm underpaid by 15 or 20 grand. I'm like, dude, what's that on a monthly basis? All right, 1,000, 1,500, 2,000 bucks. Like, yeah, that stinks, but like, still pay your bills. And in 2 years, it'll be different, hopefully. And like, by the way, what's your other option? No job? You're going to go back home to mommy and daddy? So that's like what people would rather do. They'd rather go home than actually take a job that they think they aren't being adequately compensated for. And I'm sure there's tons of people out there who would be like, you know, you're part of the problem, Ray. You're one of the people who's not paying people well. But those are my honest opinions about the American economy and the American workforce right now.
That was deep. A lot. That was more than I was getting ready for.
I did have a follow-up question to that, which is what happens if there are not necessarily for your company, but generally for developers, what happens if there is a run out of money? I mean, I would imagine if the bank that you're banking with, that you get a commercial debt with, goes under or gets acquired by another bank, the acquiring bank doesn't always have to assume all the debt on their books, correct? And so there are those developers are basically out of luck. They have to go out and then get, you know, new debt.
It's a better question. Yeah, it's a better question for my business partner, Dean. To be honest with you, he could probably give you a very educated question. What I can tell you is this for certainty. I don't know what happens. And that's scarier than knowing a bad thing, right? It's the unknown unknowns that'll really kick your ass. So I don't know what happens. And maybe they don't respect the covenants in my agreement. Maybe they don't honor the disbursements. I don't know. But I do know this. We buy our land with cash. And when you do construction financing, most banks finish that loan because a half-built asset isn't worth anything to anybody. Right. So that's the only leverage you have when you're a developer is, hey, man, I'm halfway through this thing. You really going to stop us? Like, what? I mean, now we're all up, you know what I mean, upstream without a paddle if you stop. So if you buy your dirt with cash, you're a lot safer. You buy your dirt with debt, you're in trouble. You get construction financing, do yourself a favor. Build that as fast as you can. And that's all I have to say about that.
Right. Got it. Thanks.
You said something interesting where you said, you know, when interest rates are high or rising, construction loans fare better than permanent financing?
So I was just going to say you can handle higher interest rates in your construction loan because the duration's shorter, right?
Right.
So think about it. If I have a 24-month build, but I have a 30-year mortgage, like which interest rate's going to, if it's 6% at 30 years or 6% at 24 months, 24 months isn't so bad when you look at it on a relative basis. Second to that, you can phase assets, right? Like if I have a 422-unit development, I can build 250 units at first, phase it, not take on as much construction debt, hopefully ride out some of the interest rate hikes and refine a decent market and then leverage that already built asset to then get better financing on the second phase because I have an operating asset that can be used as collateral. Hopefully you don't have to collateralize the whole thing. You know, it gets complicated. But my point is you have more ways to work the deal from the construction side. But when you lock in long-term debt at a high rate with defeasance fees and things of that nature, you're in a totally different position. So that's what I was trying to get at. And I found that out just by running the numbers, right? I'm not some kind of financial wizard, but I'm talking to my buddy Andrew. And I'm like, Andrew, what's going on with the debt here? How much is it affecting us? And he'll be like, honestly, construction timing's pretty quick, and if we two-phase the project, it's not as bad. He's like, it's that perm debt, though, really eats away at your NOI, right? And every dollar of NOI can be worth like $8 to $15, depending upon what type of market you're in and value. So it's, you know, it cuts a lot deeper on the perm side than it does the construction side is what I was driving at.
Okay. And let's move on to the legislative risk for, you know, everyone else who's outside Florida. How do you see government treating and looking at build-to-rent going forward?
I mean, fortunately and unfortunately, government actors are usually not the most sophisticated ones. So, you know, if somebody told me I can't build something for rent, then I would just say, hey, I'm building a single family community, and I'd plat it. And the second I'm done platting it, I'd say, okay, well, actually, I'm not going to sell any of the homes. I'm just going to keep them. Problem solved. So that's the build-to-rent angle. The multifamily angle, you know, you have your NIMBYism out there and everything. But really, people just don't understand future land use and things of that nature. You look at the future land use map. As long as you're in the proper land use, and you might be asking for more density or more this or more that, it gets technical. But the point is this is, no state is going to come out and say, you can't build any more rental units. They always want a horse trade. That's what politicians are. They're nothing but horse traders and pork barreling individuals. So all you have to do is give them what they want that lets them save face in front of their voters, and you'll get what you need. If somebody tries to put rent rental restrictions or rent caps or whatever, I'm not in that state. I'm not in that county. I would never build in those places. Full disclosure, I don't build in blue states. I just don't do it right now. I will maybe one day, but right now I don't. And, you know, if I ever saw somebody try and say that, basically, let's put it this way. When you buy land, property rights are some of the most innate values in this country, right? Property rights are like the center of being a free American. So if somebody tried to say that I bought something and I couldn't exercise my property rights, I mean, it's just a world I can't imagine. So I think really where the legislative risk comes in is when you try and do something outside the future land use or outside the current zoning or outside the norm. And in that case, that's the risk you took on. You should have understood that from the beginning. But I can't speak to California. I can't speak to New York. I can't speak to any of those states that are pushing things like, oh, you can't build a big community, but you can build DADUs, like additional dwelling units and things like that. It's just like, it's like fighting a fire with like water droplets. It's how do you satisfy the demand of rental and lack of housing by building a couple additional dwelling units? And all that really does is make sophisticated investors more rich because they're able to negotiate and find unique ways to enter the market. So yeah, I mean, I wish I had more for you on the legislative front, but I just stay the hell away from people who would want to say that I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I'm in their area, because in that case, then fine, they can have the problems that they already have.
Yeah. I'm in New York City, so I get what you mean.
Listen, my whole family is in New York. It's sad what's going on up there, 'cause it's such a cool place. And, talk to people all the time. It's so like unique. They're like, whatever they're doing, you know, you got these guys doing like 10 unit developments because they don't want to deal with certain legislation because they have to kick out the legacy tenants or whatever. It's so confusing. And like, I went to law school and I know I could figure it out, whatever, but it's like the brain damage is just unreal. It's like, why not just build in a better state? Like, why? You pay all these extra taxes, you do all this extra stuff, and what do you get for it? I don't understand it. I really don't get it. So, I mean, it's flashy. It's cool. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to build a skyscraper in Manhattan one day, but it doesn't seem worth it.
Yeah. Six Flags sounds more fun, honestly, than trying to build a six skyscraper up here.
Wasn't it Amazon wanted to bring a place to New York, and like AOC or whoever like threw a fit?
HQ2, yeah, they were thinking about it. Yeah.
It's hilarious. It's like, seriously, you just, the amount of handouts New York has given to affordable developers, and then they crap on big companies trying to make a difference and everything. And you know, Amazon would probably end up building housing just like Bob Iger does for Disney down here in Florida. It's a joke. These politicians, all they do is look for things that they can sell to their voters, which I totally get that the politician's first job is to stay in office. But some of them take that way too seriously.
Yeah. Could you talk about your competitive advantage? Is it because you buy at the right price? Is it because you are in the market early enough? Like, what prevents your competitors from coming into Florida and doing the same thing? Or are you just, sourcing deals?
I always say, So first off, cash will help you catch up to anybody, right? So anybody can overspend and catch up to me. But I think the fact that we get into land early is a competitive advantage. The fact that we're usually in markets a little bit earlier than other people are is a competitive advantage. And then last to that, it's our relationships that make us really different. And that's some amorphous, like qualitative, not really, empirical difference or whatever. But at the end of the day, if you ask anybody, why do they do a deal with Southern Waters Capital or Ray Mazzi? It's probably because they trust me, number one. But a little bit more important than that is you can't lose when you buy the dirt as cheap as we do in the locations that we buy it in. And I de-risk the deal by bringing the entitlements to the table and I get a competitive price because I go through the entitlement process and I negotiate with the seller. I tell my investors all the time, like, look, I'm not here to play chess with you. I played chess with the seller. I already figured that out. I was like, I'm here to put a puzzle together with you. Imagine we're sitting at the table next to each other. We're looking for corner pieces and border pieces, and we'll see if we can make it work. And if we can't, I'll see you on the next puzzle. But if we can, I'm looking forward to making a masterpiece with you. So it's really, it's relationships, it's basis, it's location, and it's identifying sub markets, tertiary markets, secondary markets, whatever you want to call them. The markets outside the MSAs that are just as strong as those MSAs, but haven't been recognized by the institutions. For instance, Ocala, we were there 2 years before everybody else was hemming and hawing about how great it is. And 2 years ago, everybody I'd bring it up to was like, Ocala, what's that? And now when I bring it up, they're like, ah, you don't have to explain the market to me. And if you go back to one of my other answers where I said, you know, starts out at the market, then it's the location of the market, then it's your basis, then it's your product, then it's your team. If you can sell somebody to the market, then if you're a good developer, the rest kind of comes together, right? If you like my market, I obviously have a good location if I'm a good developer. I obviously bought it right. I totally believe in the product I'm building, and I definitely believe in my team. So really, it's about choosing the right markets, getting in at the right price, getting in a little bit before the crowd, but not too early. You want to be on the leading edge, not the bleeding edge, because you'll end up not being able to close on something. But really, those are the things. It's the relationship, the price, the location, and our ability to be a little bit ahead of the institutional players.
Do you see a cycle? Talk about, I forget whether it's like a 7 to 10 year cycle. Do you expect to get out early enough so that, you know, you're introducing your investors to a market, and once there's saturation in the market, people start buying in, do you expect to get out of that market and enter into another market nearby, or another market where people have
the same? No, really. I mean, like I mentioned earlier, it's really about being able to hold something for 10 years at least. We're always long-term focused, value-oriented. But at the same time, you know, if I can exit, achieve my investors' returns that I promised them without capturing any more risk, then it's my duty to do that for them. But to speak to your point directly, what's great about it is when somebody comes into my market and they start buying stuff after me, they always pay more than me. They always do. Such a great comp. Every time somebody buys a piece of dirt, I'm cheering them on. Thank you so much, because you literally just paid 2x or 2.5x or 3x what I paid. And now when my investors call me, I'm like, hey, guess who just bought dirt down the street from us in a worse location at 2x the price? So-and-so. And they'll be like, wow, I had no idea they'd come to this market. Like, yeah, well, there's already institutional money coming in. Told you we were right. Told you we were ahead of it. And look, even if I was wrong at this basis, you're not going to lose money. That's the key. Even if I'm wrong about the market as a whole, we at least bought the asset at a price where you're not going to lose money. And that comes from my business partner, Dean's background. He's a bond guy. Things can only go down is the way he looks at it. It's preservation of capital first. So that's how we roll. We're in a position where we want to make sure we can multiply our money in the worst case scenario and exponentially increase it in the best case scenario.
Got it. Thanks.
And where do you see the future of build-to-rent going? Not even just in the U.S., right? I've been reading our articles and stuff where there's build-to-rent communities in the U.K. I think it's even starting in, you know, New Zealand and Australia. Where do you see this trend going, even globally?
Yeah, no. I mean, again, one of my previous answers, it's been around already for a long time. So I think what's happening is it's starting to get labeled. It's starting to get institutionalized. So what happens when that happens? Things grow. You look at the flow of capital, right? The flow of capital is going to continue to flow to build to rent. It's going to continue to flow there. So over time, you'd assume cap rates would go down. Over time, you'd assume purchase prices are going to go up. Over time, you assume demand will at least remain the same, if not increase. But really, I think every deal needs to be looked at on a deal-by-deal basis. But as an asset class overall, it's here to stay. I mean, it was already here. Like I said, it's here to stay, and now it's been labeled, and Wall Street's accepted it. So Goldman, all the big dogs, and JP, and Morgan Stanley, and all those guys and gals will dump money into this place. and I'm sure they'll into this asset, I should say, and I'm sure they'll inflate it a little bit too much, like they always do, and it'll come down a little bit. But at the end of the day, it's not going anywhere. And you know, the reason the big institutions like it is because of the optionality. They're able to sell the homes individually if they wanted to. So it's just horizontal multifamily. It's all it is. And the platting it instead of keeping it on one plat, like having individual plats for each home, is nothing but providing optionality. And supposedly it gives you better financing as well. So yeah, short answer is it's here to stay. It's going to grow. Where's its peak? I don't know. But we'll be sure to buy under it.
Yeah. That's good to hear. It's good to hear. John, any other questions you had or Ray, anything?
I think I'm good. I mean, I guess any parting comments or questions or advice for either your investors or aspiring BTR developers?
Yeah, I'll give a little bit of advice here. Is you know, the key is you need to have the Gary V says this a lot. It's like you need to have macro patience and micro speed, right? So every day work as hard as you can, you know, do everything you can in that day, but at the same time you got to be able to zoom out and be patient. And I can tell you right now, I'm one of the most impatient people you'll ever meet. And if I knew how long it took to get development deals done, I might have never started. And if I knew how expensive it was and how tough it was, I might never have started. But one thing I can say is that if you keep at it and you you understand your value and you understand what you bring to the table, you're going to be all right. And just be conservative. Conservatism has like lost its trendiness. I don't know what happened. I don't know why it's cool to be aggressive and all that kind of stuff. It's not. It should definitely be. Everybody who's trying to get into this business needs to be very conservative, be very patient, but work like a dog every single day. And that would be my parting advice to any aspiring developers. But one thing I would like to shamelessly plug, if you don't mind, is we support a charity here at Southern Waters Capital. We started a branch of the Friendship Circle, which we call the Friendship Circle Cafe, which is on Las Olas Boulevard here. But we have a charity golf classic that we're hosting in late this year. So if anybody wanted to go to Friendship Circle Charity Classic.com. We'd appreciate any support. Whether you can show up, hit a few golf balls with us, or just send in a dollar, $5, $10, whatever it is. It helps those with developmental disabilities reach their highest and best potential in the workforce. So we give them on the job training and all that kind of stuff. So it's a really great program. Feel free to Google it. But anyway, that's our main cause and what I care about most in regard to what I want to sell to your people and to my people. So again, Friendship Circle Charity Classic.com. We'd appreciate any support.
That sounds good, Rick. And where can people find out more about you, or how can they reach out to you?
Yeah. So what we do, or the best way to reach me, is LinkedIn for sure. And believe it or not, I put my cell phone in the contact. It's always funny. People are like, how do I get a hold of you? I'm like, literally click that contact button. It has my cell phone and my email address. And if you abuse it, I'll block you from both. But if you don't, I will totally respond, and I'll be as open and responsive as I can be. But if you don't have LinkedIn, go to southernwaterscapital.com, and my phone number is on there too. And so is my email. And again, if you abuse it, I'll block you. But if not, I'm super happy to talk to you.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, thanks again, Ray, for taking the time today to talk with us about Build-to-Rent, the market, Crystal Lagoons, and more. And we'll definitely have you on
sometime
soon.
Sweet. Thank you both. I appreciate the time.